Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, well, good morning. I'd like to welcome you to this one-day symposium on DNA repair and cancer evolution and therapy. We have six fantastic speakers, and I warmly thank them for being here. We have our attendees here and our attendees online that will come later on. And we're looking forward to a day of exciting science. And I would first like to welcome Ketan Patel from the Weatherhall Institute in Oxford, who will be talking about sources of endogenous DNA damage and mutations in the blood. Ketan, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Hugh. And it's a great pleasure to come to Paris. I've never seen Paris so tidy before in my life. But it's always a wonderful place to come and visit. So I'm going to tell you about work from my lab, which addresses, I think, quite a fundamental question, which is, what is the origin of the majority of mutations, somatically acquired mutations, in tissues, but particularly with reference to the blood? I'm going to begin with this slide. Now, this, of course, is a very famous slide. It isn't actually the famous slide, because this is a photograph taken just before the iconic photograph was taken.
Speak into the mic.
Before the iconic photograph was taken, and actually it shows Francis Crick with his hands wrapped around the double helix. And he probably didn't know it at the time, because what he was doing was fixing base damage. Repair reaction called base excision repair. But in fact, he wasn't doing it because he'd invented the field, but actually he needed to take this famous photograph, which is a subsequent one. Now, going back to the origin of the structure of DNA, it took some years to recognize that actually DNA is intrinsically fragile as a molecule. If you put it into solution, for instance, it spontaneously decays. And that's mainly because the bases are chemically unstable in many ways, but also occasionally lesions form within the bases. So this is without much interference. It's just the natural chemistry of solution, water and oxygen. Now, we've come to realize that these chemical changes, spontaneous decay of DNA, in our cells happens, and this really leads to a cycle of trying to fix this, but occasionally, in the process of fixing it, we get misrepair, and that is the origin of most single nucleotide mutations. And what I'm showing you here is the sort of very famous, well-known mutagraphs invented, really, by our colleagues at the Sanger, which really are kind of a mutation seismograph of the genome in our somatic cells. Now, if you're not familiar with looking at these profiles, all it shows you is the base changes, single nucleotide base changes at the top, and each bar represents the 3' and the 5' nucleotide context in which this occurs. And you will see that the majority of mutations occur at cytosine to leading to cytosine to thymine change, and that's really because of the intrinsic instability of uracil, of cytosine to uracil. I like to think of this mutation signature as really the mutation signature of life, and it's known as mutation signature 5 in the Sanger lexicography, and it's present in many tissues. And in the next slide, I'll really want to tell you some very interesting features about this mutation profile, which have really challenged our view of how mutations occur in our somatic tissues. So mutation signature 5 happens in all cells in our bodies. So if you look at a neuron in an elderly individual, you will find this mutation signature. So it's independent of cells that divide. So you do not need genome replication for this to happen. And when this was really discovered about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, in a now famous paper from the Sanger, where they invented the ability to sequence the genome of a single cell, It really challenged our view of that you always need a DNA replication for a mutation to occur. The other remarkable feature of Signature 5 is that it scales to the size of the animal and the lifespan of the animal. So mutation Signature 5 happens in murine tissue much, much faster than it happens in human tissues. And it accumulates as a function of time. So you could, in a way, look at mutation Signature 5 as a biomarker for cellular aging, independent of replicative aging. Now, one important property that somatic mutations give in all our cells is that it allows us to, if we sequence the genomes of our cells, identify a mutation barcode for each individual cell. And this mutation barcode has been extremely powerful, powerfully used by the Sanger groups to really look at something very striking that happens in human tissues. And I'm sure many of you will be familiar with this work, the first of which is this very beautiful paper from Inigo Martin Correa and Phil Jones and Peter Campbell, where they take a small square patch of the esophagus and they ultra-deep sequence it. And they develop a virtual bubble map, which really basically comes from the mutational barcodes, to try and understand the somatic evolution that's happening in this tissue. And the white areas in this represent sequence or cells that haven't diverged from mother and father, but occasionally, right, I've done something here. I might have lost my... remember I told you that the bubbles represent the emergence of clones. So what does this look like as a function of time? What you can see immediately here is if you do this sort of analysis in the human esophagus, from the age of 20 to by the time you go to the age of 45, we managed to fix it, by the way, you can see that the esophagus becomes dominated by warring clones, okay? And by the time you're 70, your entire tissue becomes a somatic tapestry of warring clones. And in fact, you will see that within clones are clones growing and emerging and being selected for. I think this is a very important observation because it turns out that if you look at the sequences enriching in these clones, many of these cells have acquired all the necessary mutations to actually become a cancer, but actually look just like normal esophageal cells. So there is an important area of cancer research which we need to revisit, which is what is it that wakens up the latent cancer genome? And that's very beautifully exemplified from the Sanger work. Now, moving forward, the same type of analysis was done by the Sanger groups using the bone marrow. But of course, the bone marrow, being a liquid tissue, required them to take bone marrow tissue and then grow it as clones and then obtain whole genome sequences and in a similar way to build lineage trees. And when the Sanger group did this, what you need to take away here is if you sequence many of these blood stem cell clones from a young individual, what you can see is that they have many, many ancestors, right? That's what this comb-like diagram tells you. However, by the time you do the same sort of analysis in someone who's significantly older, 81-year-old male, you can see there's a dramatic degradation of the production of blood. And what this tells you is that actually, rather than the blood coming from many, many stem cell ancestors, in this particular instance, almost half of the blood is coming from a single ancestor. And this is a phenomenon known as clonal hematopoiesis. It is a very important field of research right now because it turns out that not only is this an age-related degenerative condition of blood, but it's also a very strong predictor of whether you will go on to develop other morbidities like vascular disease, blood cancers, and ultimately abnormal blood production in response to infections. So I want to now go back to the real fundamental question. None of the selection and mosaicism that I described to you can really happen if DNA wasn't unstable. And so the really fundamental question is, what is it that drives the intrinsic instability of DNA? And I kind of already alluded to this point earlier in my talk. But much of the thinking in this field comes from a review written by my good friend Thomas Lindahl in 1993. And it's a fantastic review, because what Thomas sets out in this review is that DNA is intrinsically unstable, and that the major drives of DNA instability are these two molecules, water and oxygen. And of course, you cannot do without water and oxygen, okay? So most of the chemistry that drives DNA degeneration, ultimately the origin of mutations, are due to these two molecules. But is it only these two? And I hope by the end of my talk, I'll have convinced you that together with the water and oxygen, you probably have to think of this particular molecule, formaldehyde. Okay. Now, why did we come to think about formaldehyde and acetaldehyde, these two very simple reactive aldehydes, as being potent mutagens attacking DNA in quite fundamental ways? Well, we know that they cause a characteristic lesion on DNA, which is to glue the two strands of DNA together. These are known as known as strand crosslinks, inter and intra-strand crosslinks. We also know that actually this is happening all the time in our cells, because there's a repair system devoted to removing them. And if you lack this repair system, then you get a very catastrophic human disease known as Fanconi's anemia, where children have multiple developmental defects, but what ultimately kills them is bone marrow failure and a huge predisposition to leukemia. So what I'd like to show you is the evidence to suggest that actually it's these two molecules that drive the formation of these crosslinks. But before I do so, I need to tell you where they come from. So I'm going to really mainly focus on formaldehyde. The work we've done on acetaldehyde is well known, and I'll illustrate that in the next few slides. But formaldehyde is produced in our bodies, and there are two enzymatic systems that remove it. And it's converted ultimately to formate, which the cell uses in one carbon metabolism. And these two enzymes are conserved all the way from bacteria to humans. So the protection of removing formaldehyde before it gets an opportunity to cross-link your DNA is present in all kingdoms of life. Now, in order to really prove genetically that formaldehyde was necessary and sufficient to cause DNA crosslinks, which necessitated repair, some years ago my lab did a very simple genetic test. So if you take mice that lack the DNA crosslink repair system, the FANCD2 mice, and you take either of the two enzymes that clear acetaldehyde and formaldehyde away, you get a profound genetic interaction. And in fact, what happens is mice that don't normally develop the human condition, which is bone marrow failure and leukemia, if you take away the clearance of formaldehyde or acetaldehyde, develop this very, very quickly. But of course, this is a purely genetic argument. And it became very important for us to really test this and really prove that the aldehyde was necessary and sufficient to cause this. So turning to acetaldehyde in the first instance, we know that the body produces acetaldehyde, but much of it comes from an exercise I was involved in yesterday evening, which is the drinking of fine white wine. So when you drink fine white wine, it's converted by an upstream enzyme to acetaldehyde. And then there's this key enzyme, that, as I've alluded to, ALDH2, that converts it to acetate. And of course, if you remove ALDH2, then what would happen is that you would spontaneously accumulate DNA crosslinks. And if you now take away the DNA repair pathway, then you should get a profound phenotype, okay? Also to point out that ALDH2 is a very, deficiency is a very common trait in humans. So 500 million people have what's known as the alcohol flushing mutation in East Asia. And I'll come back to this later on my talk. So we have a very colorful protocol for all these experiments, and this is called the Costa del Sol protocol, because in the summer we go to a hot place in Britain, and we stop drinking water and go into a continuous alcohol supply, right? So what's a Costa del Sol protocol? We take our sensitized mice and allelic controls, and we give them 10 days of alcohol, and then we sacrifice them at the end. And if we do this, wild-type and allelic control mice really don't have any problems. But in a double mutant mouse that lacks the ability to clear acetaldehyde, lacks DNA cross-link repair, the bone marrow is completely wiped out. And what this tells us is if you allow the acetaldehyde to accumulate, it will cross-link DNA. And if you lack DNA repair, then you'll wipe out your blood production. So it, in a way, it tells you potentially how cytotoxic ethanol is. Now, I'm summarizing a lot of work from my lab over the last 12 years. And what we've done is really postulate the concept of two-tier protection against formaldehyde and acetaldehyde. And it's probably formaldehyde that's the main aldehyde. Tier one protection is removal of this of formaldehyde. And I already told you about the flushing mutation, and I will allude to this unusual genetic disease later on in my talk. But if you were to overwhelm or lack tier one protection, then you're entirely dependent on two DNA repair pathways, the first being the Fanconi repair pathway, which actually uses the repair of DNA crosslinks by using DNA replication. And that is why it predominantly affects cells that rapidly divide, like those in the blood. But a couple of years ago, we also identified another repair pathway, which is the repair system that removes DNA damage that stalls transcription. We've had this again. Good. I think it's something to do with this connection. And if you lack this, you get this disease called Cockayne syndrome, which is a premature aging disease where you get neurodegeneration. But the damage that causes transcriptional stalling had been elusive for some time, and our genetic experiments support that formaldehyde damaging the template probably contributes to this. In fact, there are a slew of papers in Nature Cell Biology from other labs recently that have given more mechanistic flesh to this, but I won't talk more about it. But essentially, if you can't remove a crosslink in a non-dividing cell, you don't really care about it unless it impedes transcription, and that's why you've got this repair system. Okay, I'm going to tell you two unpublished stories now. The first story is we wanted to know, is it important for you to break down the formaldehyde within a blood stem cell, right? Or is most of the degradation of formaldehyde happening in other tissues like your liver, and actually it's coming from an outside source? So what we did was we made a very fancy knockout mouse where we conditionally only delete the formaldehyde clearing enzyme in the blood compartment, okay? And the rest of the mouse is formaldehyde clearance proficient. And of course, to see the phenotype, you have to also take away the DNA repair side of this equation. So we get an interesting result here. So if you constitutively, you can't clear formaldehyde in the whole animal, the animals die very quickly. But if you can't clear it just in the blood compartment, animals live longer, but they eventually die of bone marrow failure and leukemia. But the really interesting paradox here was that actually when we studied the stem cells in these blood-specific knockouts, we couldn't actually see any hematopoietic stem cells at all, immunophenotypically, or by transplantation. So if we took the bone marrow out from these mice, they had no activity. If you tried to analyze all the bone marrow from all the axial skeleton, you could possibly get one single event. So how is it that these mice are producing blood for up to a year? And we're fortunate that a colleague of ours in Cambridge was working with a really brilliant German mathematician in Heidelberg called Thomas Hofer, and he introduced a really cool method. Now, remember at the beginning of my talk, I showed you the work done at the Sanger Center using ultra-deep sequence to then deconvolute lineage trees. Now, what I didn't tell you is that each of those papers costs north of 5 to 10 million euros to do. So we can't do that, right? So so you need a simpler method to approach this. And I hope I'll convince you that Thomas's method allows you to just simply do that. So before that, I need to introduce you how you do this analysis. So imagine you've got a hematopoietic stem cell, and it's giving rise to progenies, right? And what you're now looking at is the appearance of somatic mutations, or what's known as variants, okay? And if you look at the accumulation of variants in that population of blood cells, it should be steadily increasing as a function of time, okay? If every now and then a particular lineage dominates purely by drift, you will see, when you look at the variants in this population, you will see this as a representation of drift when you plot it on this particular graph, okay? However, every now and then you get the phenomenon of clonal hematopoiesis, where you get a driver mutation and you start getting dominance of a particular clone, okay? And what you then get is a graph, when you plot the variants, of this characteristic hump. And it denotes that you're getting selective advantage and a population coming out, okay? So this is the principle behind Thomas's analysis. So how do we really do this and address it in our mice, which are mysteriously producing blood for a very, very long period of time? So we did this very simple experiment. We take each mouse, which is producing blood, but doesn't seem to have any visible stem cells, and we sequence a tissue like the brain to act as a germline reference, because you need to be able to know how you're calling your variants. And then in that same mouse, you take the neutrophils and you ultra-deep sequence that to 90 times depth. And you need to do that because what you want to do is capture all the somatic variants in all the DNA that's present in the neutrophil population. And we pick the neutrophils because they have a short lifespan, so it gives you a snapshot of the history of the variants. And using Thomas's mathematical analysis, you can then build a lineage tree, okay? So what does the data look like when you do this sort of analysis? What you can see is that the allelic controls show what I showed you before, a slow, gradual accumulation of somatic variants as a function of time, okay? Now, when we do our double blood-specific knockouts, and these are a number of these mice that we've now analyzed, you see a striking profile, okay? What you can see is that almost half the neutrophil DNA carries variants that have occurred and diverge very close to the germline. And essentially what this analysis tells us is that the blood production of the neutrophils in our mice, unlike the controls, is probably coming from one single ancestor somewhere in that body. And I find it a very striking example of extreme oligoclonal hematopoiesis. We think, other than it coming from a single ancestor, clearly selection is operating to allow a particular stem cell to survive in this context. And we're quite keen to understand what selective advantages have been accrued. Have these stem cells, for instance, switched off the ability to produce formaldehyde within them? Have they, for instance, developed resistance? Have they induced an alternate repair pathway? Now, you probably know the famous American investor, Warren Buffett, said, "Beware of the young man with the long mathematical equation," right? Because if someone tells you, well, here's a fancy equation that's going to give you everything you want to know, you've got to be, I would be naturally suspicious of that. And actually, it turned out that in our deep sequencing, in one mouse, there was a predicted chromosomal translocation that was happening in the common ancestor. So to validate Thomas's method, we did the ancient way of looking at this, which is actually to metaphase spread the bone marrow cells and then actually see the prevalence of this translocation. And in fact, all the blood cells carry this, right? So I think this is this validates Thomas's method cytogenetically. And just to give you an idea, this sort of analysis for a mouse costs about 1,000 to 2,000 pounds. And that's compared to the Sanger analysis, which is anything north of 100,000. So, you know, I think this method is very powerful and it allows you to get the same analysis. It may actually give you more information because Thomas is able to compute rate of cell division and so forth. I haven't had time to tell you, but what this really tells us for clearing formaldehyde, all the action probably happens very early in development. Part of the clues come from the the graphs I've shown you, because what you notice is that the mutations that identify the common ancestor really coincide very close to the germline. So it's probably very early on from the point of hematopoietic specification that production of formaldehyde within those cells actually is very damaging to hematopoiesis. We think it's cell intrinsic, because if you restrict it just to the blood compartment, you get a strong phenotype. And then this drives a very striking uniclonal blood. Okay, I'm now going to switch tack, and some of this is published, but I'll end on a very provocative unpublished set of work we've done, which goes to some basic chemistry. Now, remember, the example I've shown you is where we've taken away tier 1 protection enzyme ADH5 together with this tier 2 repair system, Fanconi's anemia. Some time ago, we asked, well, is tier 1 and tier 2 always mutually redundant? So we made a series of knockout mice between tier 1 enzymes, okay? So if you take away, one of the double mutant mice we made are those that lack this ADH5 enzyme and the famous alcohol flushing mutation, okay? And normally, the single knockout mice have no phenotype. And if you do this, you get a profound genetic interaction, which is most of the mice die, but the few that survive have a very striking phenotype, which is that they prematurely age, and they die of leukemia and other cancers. But the majority, I've got this again. What you notice is that what this simple experiment tells you is that the two enzymes are redundant to each other, and the question is what's their substrate. And working with atmospheric chemists, we measured blood formaldehyde for the first time reliably. What I can tell you is that there's quite a lot of formaldehyde in a mouse, about 2 to 4 micromoles of formaldehyde coursing around the circulation. But you can notice in the double mutant mice, it's really massively up. It's about 50 to 60, and that's about halfway towards the levels you require to embalm tissue. So I think it's quite amazing that you have animals out there that accumulate endogenous formaldehyde, which are nearly preserved like mummies, right? But can exist. Now, about the same time, we talked to our Japanese colleagues, and they had a mysterious group of children with Fanconi's anemia clinically, but they couldn't detect a DNA repair defect. And remember, in Japan and China, up to a quarter of the population will carry deficiency of already one of the enzymes in aldehyde clearance, the flushing mutation. And in fact, these children are the correlates of our mice, right? So they lack ADH5, they have a mutation of ADH5 as well as the flushing mutation. And actually, they have small stature, and they get bone marrow failure, but they have other features which overlap with the other repair system, which is Cockayne syndrome, so they get features of neurodegeneration and so forth. You will see that this one young 14-year-old girl is severely pigmented. And what we know is that the circulating level of formaldehyde actually damages skin epithelial cells, and that secretes a factor that tells melanocytes to secrete melanin, because the skin is fooled into thinking that the DNA damage is coming from sunlight. So actually, this is a very striking phenomenon we see in our mice as well as in the humans. Now, at the beginning of my talk, I talked about signature 5, right? Now, we now have a very clear situation where DNA repair is intact, so the mutation imprinting factory is present, but you have a strong endogenous mutagenic driver, which is formaldehyde. So using the rather expensive method that Peter had developed at the Sanger, we obtain the mutation signature from blood stem cells in our wild-type mice, and reassuringly, this is mutation signature 5, okay? So what does it look like in these formaldehyde superaccumulating mice? What you can see immediately is that all classes of mutations go up. And if you put this into an algorithm, what it does come back is very strong similarity to mutation signature 5. Now, it's not as simple as that, because mutation signature 5 is a compound of many drivers. But what we can say is that endogenous formaldehyde likely contributes to mutation signature 5. Now, these mice actually have only half the level of stem cells that the normal mice do, and actually they can make blood throughout life. So they don't really, unlike the humans, they don't have that severe a bone marrow defect. And remember, clonal hematopoiesis in humans as we age is a very subtle phenotype. You wouldn't necessarily detect it by sampling the blood. So we are quite keen to use Thomas's method in these mice. And what I'm showing you here is the analysis I've already talked about the extreme uniclonal mice. What happens if we do the same analysis in the formaldehyde superaccumulating mice? What we get, at least in this singular example, is a huge steep rise in variance, which is not a surprise because I've already told you that the endogenous formaldehyde is driving a natural level of mutation, which is about four or five times higher than the endogenous, the natural rate. But what you can see is that you get this steep up climb over here. And if you compute this into Thomas's algorithm, it says that at least 30% of the neutrophil production is coming from a single ancestor. And this is very similar to the kind of clonal hematopoiesis you see in humans. So we're very excited about this work because to now, the entire focus of clonal hematopoiesis research is about how the somatic clone acquires competitive advantage. But nobody really studies the mutation, the origin of what drives those mutations. And at least in this example, we can say that formaldehyde damage is sufficient to create clonal hematopoiesis in mice. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's a significant contributor to clonal hematopoiesis in the human population generally. Now, I have a gripe to pick because if you ever read reviews about clonal hematopoiesis, the leading proponents in the field devote one paragraph to the origin of mutations. And they begin with a statement saying, these mutations arise during DNA replication. And then they dismiss the whole field. They're actually wrong about that because the signature that drives those somatically acquired mutations happens in non-dividing as well as dividing cells and actually is probably due to the intrinsic chemistry of DNA decay. We did another animal and we get a similar result again. So we're really quite excited about this result. Now I'm going to switch a little bit to tell you some fundamental chemistry on arguably probably the most important experiment my lab has recently done, and actually it's the cheapest experiment my lab's ever done. Now, one important thing we had to prove is that we have all these situations where formaldehyde is accumulating. Does it ever get the opportunity to damage DNA, and can we actually see the damage in DNA or have a biomarker for it? And it turns out that formaldehyde attacks the amines on the purines classically. And it attacks the amines on guanine and creates an adduct known as N2-hydroxymethylguanine. And we can actually detect this adduct because if you reduce if you take the DNA from animals and then reduce it, you get N2-methylguanine, which using mass spectrometry, you can actually detect. And what you get really is a tenfold induction of this adduct in formaldehyde superaccumulating mice. So that immediately tells you that not only is the formaldehyde accumulating, but it is directly accessing DNA, but it gives you a biomarker of this. However, buried in this very simple description of the chemistry is some very unusual chemistry about formaldehyde, which I'll now tell you about. So when you take a bottle of formalin, which is formaldehyde in water, most of the formaldehyde exists in a hydrated form. And it constantly goes in equilibrium and switches forwards and backwards. And that is because the kind of chemical bond, covalent bond, formaldehyde creates with amines or with hydroxyl groups is reversible. And now when you think about it, that's why it's such a valuable biochemical tool, right? Because when you want to do chromatin immunoprecipitation, you want to cross-link your DNA with proteins, but it's no good unless you can reverse it, right? And so you use that same principle of reversible chemistry in order to do for analysis. But actually, this chemistry matters in how we are studying formaldehyde in our biological situations. So what Chris, an organic chemist who works in my lab, an analytical chemist who does much of the mass spectrometry work, did a very simple experiment. He basically reproduced a very simple experiment where he took the nucleoside of formaldehyde conjugated to guanine, the hydroxy N2 hydroxymethyl guanine, and put it into solution. And what you can see is this adduct disappears, okay? It reverses within a day as a single nucleotide. If you put the same adduct in the context of single-stranded DNA, it's longer. Its half-life is prolonged by about 5 to 6-fold. However, if you put it on double-stranded DNA, it's completely rock solid. So in somehow, the formaldehyde adduct, which shows this unusual reversal chemistry, seems to be restrained or bootstrapped in the context of double-stranded DNA. And we've done much more experiments on this, and we don't fully understand why this is the case. But it leads to some very simple predictions of how formaldehyde mutates and alters DNA, and why we have to use preferential repair pathways. And that is what I will show you in the next slide. So we know that formaldehyde doesn't react that well to double-stranded DNA, but imagine if you have a formaldehyde adduct in DNA, and we all have that in our genomes right now, it'll sit there silently and pervasively. Over here. And if there's a guanine opposite, it'll form a crosslink and then reverse, okay? And I think this is the lesion that the Fanconi and the TCNER pathway are probably likely to repair. However, each time you undergo a single-strand, double-stranded transition, the kinetics of its off rate change dramatically. And it has two simple predictions, that when you do these transitions, the formaldehyde on guanine is available to react with the protein and cause a DNA-protein crosslink, which is the basis of, I think, the aspects of some of the papers that were described before. Or when you copy DNA, you'd have the same thing. But there's another prediction, which is the formaldehyde might dissociate and jump somewhere else on your DNA. So I think this very simple chemical experiment is telling us a very unusual property of how this mutagen works. And I don't know of any other example of a mutagen that behaves in a way that... It's a bit like thinking that our genome, once it's exposed to formaldehyde in a double-stranded form, those adducts sit like landmines, and that each time the DNA undergoes transitions, it reveals its reactivity and causes problems or jumps to another site. Now, I'm pretty sure this will be testable because Peter, when he was looking at the clades of mutations at the very beginning of my talk, found an unusual property. He found a particular mutation clade led to templated mutations down one lineage, but suddenly completely reversed back to normal. And his prediction, his interpretation is that there's a DNA lesion that the DNA repair system can't see for several months, and then suddenly it wakes up and takes it out. But actually, I think it's probably something like this, which is reversal chemistry that he's seeing. So we're very keen to test that out, and that's what's been that will be the focus of the work in my lab into the future. So I hope at the end of my talk, I'll have convinced you that when you think about the intrinsic decay of DNA, not only water and oxygen, but you should probably put formaldehyde in the list. It's an endogenous mutagenic driver for clonal hematopoiesis, at least in the mouse, and probably in human Fanconi patients, which is something we're testing out with Jean Soulier. It's a truly unusual and pervasive mutagen, but the real million-dollar question for us is where does it come from? Because if we're able to identify where it comes from, we might be able to take that away from us or reduce its effects and reduce at least a significant burden of mutagenesis in our genome. And with that, I'd like to really acknowledge the people who did this work. The work on the blood-specific knockouts was done by Ashley Kamai-Lanning, a postdoc in my lab. the work on the 2-5 knockout mice was done by another postdoc, Felix Dingler, together with an analytical chemist, Chris Millington, who did much of the formaldehyde reversal chemistry. And I should also acknowledge Thomas Hofer, who we collaborated with, and ex-members of my lab. And we've had generous funding sources. With that, thank you very much. 5 minutes.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.